I've always struggled with finding time to manage my finances. At the end of a busy week, the last thing I want to do is spend time budgeting all of my expenses or tracking down customer service teams to cancel old subscriptions I no longer use. But now I use Rocket Money, and it does all that for me. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so you can grow your savings. Stop wasting money on the things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Washington Post. That's rocketmoney.com/Washington Post.
I'm Jonathan Capehart, and welcome to Capehart. One of the big knocks against Wall Street is that the world of finance and the capital it has access to are not very open to women and people of color. In the aftermath of the murder of George Floyd and the national protests his death inspired, Richard Parsons decided to build an equity pipeline. If anyone could get it done, it's Mr. Parsons. His resume reads like a blue-chip registry. Chairman of Citicorp, Chairman and CEO of Dime Bancorp, Chairman and CEO of Time Warner, Interim Chairman of CBS. And he's put that expertise and experience into co-founding Equity Alliance with the stated goal, quote, to democratize access to capital. In this conversation, first recorded for Washington Post Live on March 23rd, Parsons doesn't just talk about Equity Alliance. He talks about Silicon Valley Bank, the accusations of woke capitalism, and the action taken by the federal government.
The federal government stepped up and did the right thing. They learned something in 2008.
Let's talk about the leadership you're engaged in now, Mr. Parsons. What exactly is Equity Alliance, and how are you measuring success? Is it just the bottom line?
No, it's not just the bottom line. Let me start from the beginning and build up a little bit. The Equity Alliance was an idea that I had with a friend of mine named Kenny Lear. We were sitting around in the wake of George Floyd, and I was complaining about the fact that everything that people were reporting and complaining about with the George Floyd incident, it sounded like 50 years ago when I was, you know, a college student or a law school student, just coming out of school, and we had all the riots in Detroit and New York and Philadelphia. And when the commission reported on the causes of these riots. This is the point of the story. And you could have taken the first page out of that and read it 50 years later with the George Floyd incident, same issues, you know, discrimination, poor housing, lack of educational quality, lack of job opportunities, unfair policing. Nothing had changed in 50 years. It was just stunning to me. And when we thought about it, Kenny and I were sitting down thinking about it, you know, I said, the real problem is that in order to change things around, they need capital. And if you look at the way in which we allocate capital in this country, the asset management business, something like a $70 to $80 trillion business, truly. Less than 2% of that investment capital gets into the hands of minorities or women who are overlooked by our structure. I say it's structural inequality. I don't use racism because racism suggests there's an intentionality to it. And I don't believe that's necessarily true, but it is unequal. Minorities and women do not get anything close to their fair share of invested capital. So we said, you know, we obviously aren't going to change the world by ourselves. We said, what can we do to start to level that playing field? So what the Equity Alliance is, it's a bunch of folks that I know and Kenny knows from the investment world who put some money together to start a fund of funds, focuses on other emerging venture managers who are either people of color or women. And because we believe that there's a lot of talent out there being overlooked. B, we could find that talent and create an investment vehicle that gave superior returns, because, you know, there's no shortage of ideas and opportunities in the overlooked communities, particularly in the minority community. And so our objective was to set out to prove that you could as I like to say, you could find gold in them nar hills. You could find real great investment opportunity, and you get a return that was superior to the returns otherwise you'd get in the market. And our further thought was that because, you know, frankly, and this is a bit of a confession against interest, you know, we were the incumbents, all of us. I mean, I came from mainstream, by the time I got to this, mainstream America. As you mentioned, I headed up a number of S&P 500 companies and been involved in commerce and investment for years, as did Ken, as did the other fellows we bought in. And so we could then go back to our former colleagues and peers and say, hey, look, guys, take a look at this model. This works. This is a way you can invest in communities you've overlooked in the past and get a decent to superior return. So, you know, wake up. That was the point of this. You know, everybody was now woke, right, because of the George Floyd situation. But they didn't know what to do. They didn't know what to do. They wanted to do something, but they didn't know what to do. So we thought we'd try and create a model for them. Sorry to go on at great length, but I wanted to give you the background. Yeah.
Well, that's a great background to continue the conversation. And the commission you were thinking of was the Kerner Commission.
Kerner, former governor of Ohio, right? His name just went right out of my head.
Now, it's quite all right. I only know it because that was the year I was born. So I'm very mindful of 1967.
Any of your listeners, go back and read the first page, literally, of the executive session of the Kerner Report in terms of what was the root cause of this turmoil. They could think they were reading this, you know, what happened right after George Washington. Mm-hmm. 50 years had passed and nothing had changed.
So let's talk more now that you've given us the foundation of the Equity Alliance. You made your first direct investment last summer. When you're looking at an investment, walk us through your criteria. What are you looking for?
Well, we're looking for, first of all, as I said, we are emphasizing managers who are diverse, who are either people of color or women. So we're looking for people, that's the first screen, if you will. And then we look to see what the background and track record, to the extent there is one, is of these folks. I said, to the extent there is a track record, one of the problems that women and minorities have is that they don't have the track record because they haven't been able to get into the game. You know, it's like the old, I can't get a job unless I have experience, and I can't get experience unless I have a job, right? Same issue. A lot of these managers don't have the track record to put up. So you have to make a bet, if you will, on the quality of the leadership. So that's the second thing we look for. What's been your experience and what are your qualities as a leader? Because, you know, I always believe at the end of the day, I don't care whether you're running any kind of business, at the end of the day, it's all about the people. So we press hard to see if we think we've got some folks who are just going to, you know, who have skills, who have intelligence, who have insight into areas of the economy we think are going to grow, and who we think can put together a team to make it happen. And then we look to make sure that they have the fundamentals in place. In other words, you know, there are a lot of people out here who have an idea, or they have a pal, and the two of them have an idea, but they don't have any financial competence. They don't have any compliance competence. They haven't managed businesses before. We like to see a team because investing successfully is, generally speaking, a team effort. Put a team together with different skills and competence. So we look for all the same things that other investors look for. It's just that we recognize that the track record part of it is going to be skimpy. And, you know, these are usually young people who didn't go to all the right schools. Because, you know, it's part of the game here. That,
right.
You know, a couple of three or four schools that produce 75% of the entrepreneurs. And they all go to the same schools. They have the same experience. They end up in the same investment pods. And so if you would ask me what's our secret sauce, we are trying to create a community. Very interesting. You look out on the West Coast, Silicon Valley, There's a community of folks out there that meet and greet, talk to each other and support each other. They all, as I said, they all went to the same schools and they all, you know, they live the same kind of lives. Our folks don't. Our folks are not part of that community. So we're trying to build a community among this group that we're putting together so that they get the same kinds of support.
Well, Mr. Parsons, talk a little bit more about that, because about why it's important seeing people who look like you sitting around and at the head of the table, why that is so important.
Well, I'll start with an anecdote. The advice that was once given to me by an early employer, he said, you know, success in life is 10% what you know, 10% who you know, and 80% luck. Just circumstances of your birth, your parentage, the schooling, all that. Things you had less to do with than actually getting out into the workday world and trying to make a go of it. The important part to me was the who you know was just as important as the what you know. What happens in the real world is that relationships count for a ton. You know, because I'm sure that as you look back on your impressive career, there have been a lot of relationships that helped you make it way up the ladder as you've done. People who you met along the way, circumstances where you came into the view of those who could help you. So you see a lot of that. In fact, interesting, I know one of the things we're going to talk about in a minute is like this Silicon Valley situation.
Oh, yeah.
That was, to some extent, a function of the network, right? Silicon Valley leaned heavily. This is the net downside of it. It leaned heavily into the startup community, venture capital community. And as soon as one got word that, things weren't going so well, the word spread within that community and bang, they were out of business, right? Well, that works in a positive way when you're trying to raise funds to start a business. And it works in the following way. Someone you know and who has confidence in you reaches out to his or her or its network of other investors and said, hey, I know this guy, I know this gal, I know this group. I'm putting some of my money up and I think you should as well. And that's how the, if you will, the game is played. Mm-hmm. That's not a game that's been available, frankly, to minorities or to women. They didn't have those kind of relationships. So part of what we're doing is creating a community that enables them to play the same game. And this is why it's been important that investors, we can let them lean on our networks. We can introduce them to folks who can fund and to themselves to just give you a sense of confidence that if these folks can make it, I can make it.
Since you brought it up, let's keep talking about it. And by it, I mean Silicon Valley Bank. It's interesting because ESG, or environmental, social, and governance, and diversity, equity, and inclusion, or DEI, those initiatives have become punching bags. And we saw this most recently with some on the right blaming the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank on ESG.
Yeah.
Of the two people on this screen, you're the only one who has not only run a bank, you've run three banks, if memory serves. Does that even make any sense?
No, is the short answer. I've been giving you a bunch of long answers. I give you a short one there. No, this has very little to do with ESG. It had to do with, first of all, no bank, right? No bank can really withstand a run. The nature of banking is such that you take in money short, meaning you have to give it back whenever somebody shows up for it, and you lend it long. Now, Silicon Valley Bank made lots of loans in the startup space, and they also invested in some treasuries that were, at the time when interest rates were really low, looked very attractive. Well, two things happened. One, interest rates spiked, and so the treasuries they invested in lost value big time. And two, a lot of the venture loans they made were very long. I mean, you couldn't just call the guy up and say, I need my money back because my depositors are here. Back in the day, if you wanted to run on the bank, you had to literally show up at the bank to get your money, right? Today, so that would take, that takes weeks. Today, it happens in a matter of hours, as we saw on Fateful Friday, that Silicon Valley just ran out of dough. But it doesn't have anything to do with ESG or DEI. You know, some of the crazy things that some of our culture out here have asserted.
Right.
They're mistaken.
So, Mr. Parsons, you talked about some of the factors that led to the collapse of SVP. Yesterday, the Federal Reserve raised interest rates by 25 basis points or a quarter of a percent, which leads us to a question from the audience. This is a question from Aaron Coral from Arizona. Can you share your thoughts on how higher interest rates affect capital allocation to smaller minority-owned businesses?
Yeah, I'll start with referring back to what I call the structural inequity, right? Mm-hmm. This expression when I was in the service, X flows downhill. I clean that up for you. Meaning that at the bottom of the food chain always sort of get hit the hardest. What the, particularly the SVP and Silvergate Bank and the other one that went down, what that has done is it's created a constraint, let's put it that way, that banks feel to tighten their lending, right? So it's going to result, no question about it, in tighter lending. And the fact that money now costs more is also going to create a strain on the lending. Used to be, I can remember saying to people 2 years ago, money was free almost. I mean, it was so cheap. Now it ain't free anymore. And is that going to hurt minority entrepreneurs? Yes, it is, because it's going to hurt anybody trying to build a business. And that's where most of them are in the life cycle now. They're trying to build. They need capital to build. That's the whole point behind the equity alliance. You got to get capital into people's hands for them to build something. And so I expect to see more stringent lending requirements by the banks, and it's going to, like seemingly all things, it's going to impact on the minority and women community, I think, of entrepreneurs, more painfully than on mainstream business enterprises. Now, is it going to cut it out altogether? No, but it's just going to be harder.
So, what's happened with Silicon Valley Bank and Signature and Credit Suisse has me and a lot of other people thinking back to 2008. Where do you see this banking crisis going? How does it compare to what we went through, what happened in 2008?
Good question. I think that because of the fact that the federal government stepped up and did the right thing, they learned something. In 2008, they did the right thing, which was to sort of backstop all the deposits and say, we're not going to let this system, this banking system, melt down because people are afraid they're not going to get their money back. I think they nipped it in the bud. I really do. I think this is more akin. Now, this is going to go back to if you were born in the 70s, you were just a high school or college kid, and we had something called long-term capital in 1998, which one of the big investment funds broke up, and the Fed stepped in and nipped it in the bud. And there was some concern for, a week or two, what does this mean and how is this going to play out? But then ultimately the market settled down and they realized that the government was not going to let this become a contagion type of situation. 2008 was total collapse of the system. And it took a while for the government to really sort of figure out that we need to inject capital into the system to stabilize it and to restore trust. I said earlier, no banking system can exist for long unless there's trust in it. This time, they hit the mark, the following Monday after the collapse on Friday, and said, we're not going to have the trust drain out of the system. We're going to support the depositors, the the bank's depositors, and we're going to make sure that none of them lose any of their money. And so they nipped it in the bud, I think, what could have been a real disaster.
What do you say to those who say that the fact that the federal government did step in and, you know, made those depositors whole, that they're setting up a moral hazard where banks can just basically say, well, we can take all the risks we want because the federal government's just going to step in if we get into trouble?
No, I don't think that's going to happen, because what they're going to do, you watch and see, they're going to go back and revisit some of the regulatory requirements that were eased in 2018. That's the purpose of regulation, to make sure that the banks aren't being irresponsible. Moreover, the people who put the money up for the bank, the investors, and some of the lenders who are outside the scope of deposits, are going to lose money. Well, particularly the investors, and the management is going to have to be held accountable. But it's in our national interest. It's actually in the government and the people's interest to defend and protect the depositors, because you have to, you know, that's what a banking system does. I've seen some of the things written by, you know, our favorite senator from Massachusetts and others, you know, who want blood, right? There's always a pitchfork crowd that shows up. But I will tell you, I don't think any of problems that have been dealt with SVP or the other banks you mentioned are going to cost the taxpayer money, because there are more than enough assets there. This we learned in the dime, and we learned in Citi. There are more than enough assets there to cover those liabilities if you give it time. That's the thing. And doesn't give it time. You have to give it time to unwind these things.
Okay. Well, I mean, if Dick Parsons is confident in the banking system, I have no right not to be. Mr. Parsons, today there are only 6 Fortune 500 companies run by Black CEOs, which is more. It's actually a record high, more than when you were a CEO. What's preventing greater racial representation at the top of corporate America?
Well, I think it's akin to what I called earlier the structural inequalities. I mean, who sits on the boards? Boards are the ones that determine, you know, who's going to be CEO. And I can tell you from my experience, whenever I was involved either in a search or looking for somebody, and to find somebody of color, people would actually say to me, "Well, I don't know anybody. I don't know where they are." And I would say, "Well, you know, you're not going to find them at your club, right? You're not going to find them in your church. You're not going to find them living next door to you. You have to reach out." And that's just something we need to keep harping on, the reach out part. There will be more, at least. Now, I made this prediction 20 years ago when I was a CEO, that there would be many more Blacks and indeed women. But as long as we tend to live separately, again, separate nations, as long as we live separately, and as long as corporate boards in particular are white men, women are starting to come on board, but white men, it's a struggle, because we don't live together. And therefore, we don't have familiarity with each other. And until the complexion of corporate America at the board level changes more, you're not going to see that much change in the CEO job. But the complexion of corporate America, it is changing. There are more minorities, and particularly more women. And so I have hope. It's just a slow-moving process. Needs to speed up.
Richard Parsons, chairman of Equity Alliance, it is, like I said at the beginning of this conversation, a joy to see you. Thank you so much for coming to Washington Post Live.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. It's nice to see you too.
Thanks for listening to KPART. It's edited by Nick Roberts. We'll have new episodes for you every Thursday. I'm Jonathan KPART. You can find me on Twitter at KPARTJ.
The new Super Beats Heart Chews Advanced is now supercharged with CoQ10. Support your healthy CoQ10 levels and blood pressure with 2 chews a day. Visit RadioBeets, BEETS.com, and save 15% with promo code DEAL.